Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today is Associate Editor Byron Hurd. What's going on, man?
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. It is Tuesday. We're recording this, here we're a couple weeks out from Thanksgiving, so good time to talk cars and just kind of hang out. We've got a great show for you today. We've got Byron's going to tell us about his time in the EcoBoost Mustang with the Performance Pack, which I think is a really interesting combination. And he spent some time in the Kia Telluride. We're going to talk a little bit of, in the news segment, more on the Mustang, this time the Mach-E variety. We're seeing that Lincoln may get sort of a sibling based on the same platform, which is interesting. And finally, we'll wrap things up with a Spend My Money update. Teaser alert, it involves a Porsche. So let's jump right in. Byron, Ford Mustang EcoBoost. That's interesting. I assume this is the four-cylinder EcoBoost, right?
Yes, that's right.
And with the Performance Pack, which I don't know about you, but I really like the Performance Pack, what it does with the Mustang. I think for your money, it's frankly the best way you can spend your money on a Mustang rather than stepping up to like a Bullet, a Mach 1, a Boss 302 when that was a thing. If you've just got like a few extra, you know, dollar bills to spend, it gives you the most, I think, you know, value for your money. But yeah, tell me about this car. What'd you do with it?
I'm of the same mindset that you are when it comes to the performance packages. So I got this one right after, it was something else that was kind of on the sporty side of things. I think it might've been the new BMW 4 Series. So it was, you know, one turbo coupe into another turbo coupe. And I was really, this is the first time I've driven any EcoBoost Mustang. I've driven some of the older V6s, and I owned a 2015 with the V8, and that one was actually a performance package with the Recaro seats. So that was like the internet forum spec where you spent as little as possible to get the most performance you could. And loved that car. It was great. This one, I liked the performance package a lot. The automatic transmission kind of was a hit or miss for me. Like it operated fine, but it wouldn't be my choice. The thing that really actually turned me off about the car was it was a premium model with the high performance package, and it had the really plush leather seats in it that made me feel like I was sitting on top of them instead of in them, because I'm used to the nice, deep, aggressively bolstered Recaro seats that you can get in the Mustangs. And so my 15 had the Recaros, and the 2018 GT Performance Package 1 I drove a year or two back also had Recaros, and those were leather. And they didn't feel as kind of soft and bench-like as the seats in this one did. It's also interesting with the high-performance package on the EcoBoost, you get a square tire setup. I think it's 265s all around. And that's interesting because the combination of that and the smaller engine over the front axle really makes the car feel very lively on turn-in. Like, you can... Not only can you tell that there's a whole lot less weight up front compared to the V8s, but with that extra tire up there, there's just a lot more transitional grip, and you can kind of just point this thing into a corner without thinking about it. So I found that very appealing. I'm not wild about the exhaust note. The 2.3 turbo kind of sounds like a Focus RS, which I'm assuming is exactly what they were going for. And that sound coming out of a Focus RS works for me. You know, it's a rally car type setup. It's fine. But from a Mustang, it doesn't quite work as well, in my opinion. Sound and looks are all very personal choices. And especially with a performance car, it's not like you're limited to the way it comes from the factory, because it's really easy to go out and get an aftermarket exhaust. And, I mean, I even did that on my 5-liter. You know, it's like inevitably you're going to want to personalize it to some degree. So I won't fault Ford for the way it sounds out of the box. I think my biggest issue with it is just, despite the fact that it does feel like a lighter, more nimble car, it's still big. And it just, especially like with that 10-speed automatic, it's constantly shifting gears because the torque band of that engine is so much narrower than the V8s. So it sounds cliche and like a cop-out, but it doesn't really feel like a Mustang. And if it weren't a Mustang, I think I'd like it more. Because what it is just... notwithstanding the fact that it is a Mustang, is pretty impressive. And if it were, say, just like a dedicated BRZ-sized sports coupe with rear wheel drive and 300 horsepower from a turbo four. That sounds fantastic to me. The Mustang angle is what makes it a little awkward. And I didn't feel the same way coming out of a turbocharged Camaro a couple years ago. But I think it's because the Camaro shares its platform with these little kind of European-inspired compact Cadillacs. And just the nature of that powertrain matches the Camaro a little bit better than it does the Mustang. So, I mean, overall, I would still say it's a very pleasant and fun car to drive and very capable. It just doesn't quite tick the boxes I expect from something with the Mustang nameplate on it.
It's interesting. You strike me as someone who might be hard to please when the Mach-E comes out a little more, like sort of, you know, trying to evaluate what the definition of a Mustang is, you know, and like, I mean, that one is unmistakably a crossover, but then you get all this performance. I mean, I'll say this, the Mach-E for me is no problem. And I would like to see them make maybe a pure electric Mustang coupe fastback sort of thing, as opposed to just like, hey, we're going to make it a crossover. And I get the broader business case for making a crossover that's electric and putting a Mustang name on it. But you have to do a little bit of mental calibration to get it there, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I'll say this, the car you tested is not exactly how I would spec out a Mustang. Not that you had a choice, but I mean, that's just, you know, there's so many different flavors of the Mustang and different ways to do it. I don't know. I mean, the performance pack is always intriguing to me. In the 2.3 liter EcoBoost is really a good engine. I've driven it a few times. And even that automatic is a very good transmission. In some ways, I think that's, you know, when I think about it from a pure performance perspective, that automatic is so like solid that if I were going to track the car, I would probably do that over the manual, because as I remember the Mustang's like gearing and just shift action, just like the standard 6-speed manual, is it awesome? Is it all that like engaging feel that you expect from a Mustang? 100%. But if I wanted to go fast, I would let the car shift for me, if you will, and use this automatic. So, I mean, it's like I'm sort of, you know, talking out of both sides of my mouth here, but, you know, I think I'd probably still go with the V8 for the Mustang anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the transmission, the way it behaved was fine. It was, you know, it was calibrated to work with what it was connected to, and it made sense in that context. It's just that the automatic Mustangs didn't really mature into being a performance option until that 10-speed was introduced. Because even pretty early in the current Mustang's life, if I'm remembering correctly, I don't even think you could get shift paddles on the wheel in a GT until like 2018 or something like that. They might have offered it with performance package cars, but it's not one of those, like, when you go to shift in these autos, there's no like dedicated shift detent for manual mode or anything like that. There are paddle shifters on the wheel if you get the cars with the right packages for that. But prior to that, there was just like that little thumb toggle for like positive, negative gear selection on the selector. And that was, I mean, that's not a performance automatic, you know, like you're trusting the automatic to make the choices for you. That's fine, especially when with all the really advanced performance driving modes they have in these newer ones where you can put it in track mode and the computer does a really good job of choosing what gear you should be at. That's great. But on the street, that's really awkward because it's difficult to get it to just like chill in manual mode, but in a normal driving situation where you want that command over the gear selections, but you don't necessarily want it holding first gear to like 34 miles an hour or something crazy like that. So it's hard to find a real good split with this particular implementation. But when you look at like plenty of other automatics that are out there that have better options for it, I mean, you know, if you look at a Porsche PDK or a VW DSG or something like that, granted, those are twin clutch units, but a gear selector is a gear selector. And if you can pop it over into manual mode with your wrist, I really don't care what it is behind it as long as it gets the job done. And I just feel like the Ford's implementation right now is only like 75% of the way there. And it's something they can easily fix with the next generation. and get me to shut up about it, which I'm sure is their number one goal over in Dearborn, is just to get Byron to stop complaining about their Mustangs.
There you go. For those of you listening at home, this is the 10-speed automatic, which is actually shared with General Motors, which is kind of something you may or may not remember. They collaborated on the, they had like a joint venture on transmission development, which they've actually done at least once, maybe twice before. Some people were like, whoa, that's crazy. It's like, well, you know, actually, it's big news when they sort of announce it, which they never totally announce. It's like one sort of cryptic press release. And then neither side ever talks about it again, nor wants to talk about it. But it's in general, it's a pretty good all-around gearbox. And then that's a 2.3-liter EcoBoost, four-cylinder, 310 horsepower, 350 pound-feet of torque. So obviously, there's a lot to work with here. It's a very capable car. It's more capable than, frankly, most V6s were, you know, for a long time. And then the performance pack, the high performance pack, I should say. What's that do for it, and what do you think of it?
That's a very impressive package, and I really like the square tire setup for one thing, because you can rotate tires. That's beautiful. That was one of the problems with my 15, was I had, you know, 275s in the rear and I think 255 up front, and you're just stuck with it, and you know you're going to go through rear tires in that car much more quickly than you go through fronts, and of course those are the more expensive ones. So but yeah, I mean, you get a lot out of the performance package. You get the improved chassis setup, which it feels great, to be perfectly honest. I really like that. And that was one of the big draws of Performance Package 2 on the Mustang GT, which has now been phased out. You have to get the Mustang Mach 1 in order to get the same equipment that was originally in Performance Package 2, and that was your Magna Ride adaptive suspension and a couple other little goodies. But you get the things like the active exhaust, which is really nice, and stuff like that. So I would wholeheartedly recommend the high performance package for the EcoBoost model if you are an enthusiast and you do expect to do anything fun with the car at all. It's pretty much the one to buy. And I'm still a believer in the basic performance package for the GT, even though you can no longer upgrade it to get MagnaRide and all that without stepping up to the Mach 1. I'm a little upset with their choices regarding the performance tiers of Mustangs lately, because they keep firewalling the good stuff into those much more expensive cars. I mean, at this point, I would rather go out and buy a used Shelby GT350 than plop down money on a brand new Mach 1, because you get most of the same things you want out of a Mach 1, plus you get that amazing 5.2-liter flat plane crank V8, which is just delightful. So there's some unsolicited purchasing advice.
Spend Byron's money. That's a good move. I drove an M2 a couple of weekends ago, and that's a brilliant car. Of course, it costs that one I drove cost, I believe, 58 grand, or it started at 58 grand. I forget exactly what the sticker was, but a lot more money. And I often, you know, just doing some research on the car, people compare like the M2 and then some of the less, like the lesser versions of the 2 Series against the Mustang, because it is like, it's like a performance coupe, you know, and the Mustang gives you, and they're both arguably sports cars. The pony car is a little bit of its own thing, you know, because you would put Mustang versus Camaro somewhat versus Challenger, you know, a BMW 2 Series, you're getting in a different space, but it's a lot of the same idea. Like, you want a fun car with a back seat that's an actual car, as opposed to a Miata or a BRZ or a Cayman. So, I mean, I think it's reasonable to cross shop a loaded up Mustang with, you know, some of the other, you know, performance coupes out there, including the ones from BMW. And I think the segment is really strong right now. You know, I would say a better value would be to go with like a Mustang versus like, you know, some of the performance M2s, but I mean, you know, there's trade-offs. I've often found Mustangs to be quite raw, a little hard sometimes to like, I mean, I remember one time we were going to the track out in California, out to the one in Lancaster, Willow Springs, and we were driving up from the hotel for like the morning drive, and I literally, I'll admit, I probably was down a quart of coffee, did a spin out. I just was in second gear, pulled the like the wheels pretty hard just to make a hard right to like make from a stoplight. It's like 6 a.m., you know, sort of like middle California. So like nobody's around. The sun's coming up. Car just like pivoted. And I'm just like, okay, in a way we go. Now, I mean, total user error involved there, but in the tires were cold, all the, you know, stupid mistakes you make. But I mean, let me put it this way, the Mustang can be light on its feet. And granted, this was a generation of ago of the Mustang, but it's the same ethos, you know, it's a raw car, you know, and it's, you gotta be careful with that amount of performance, you know, not like the M2 is for the, you know, the lighthearted, but it's, I found that car to be more livable, if you will. So,
yes.
I mean, I don't know. Do you have a favorite in this kind of performance coupe segment? I don't know. Any other like sort of preferences?
That's tough. I mean, obviously my heart says GT350 because that engine is delightful. And I think that's probably like the most complete Mustang that they've sold in quite some time. I have a real soft spot for it. But I think if I'm just going out to spend money on something well-rounded enough to be a daily driver, but still something you take to the track, I really do think the BRZ and the 86 are tough to beat. The downside to them is if you do go for like the BRZ TS or the performance package on either of them, the ride and noise will get to you, even far more so than in a Mustang or a Camaro. I mean, a Challenger is basically a luxury coupe compared to any of the others. And so I've owned a Challenger with a 6.4 liter, and I've owned a Mustang with the 5 liter. The Challenger was the most livable, practical one, despite its size, which is kind of a downside. The Mustang was definitely the better performer. And then the Camaro, I think, kind of splits the difference between them. The only downside, really, with the Camaro from a day-to-day perspective is there's really no room for your feet anywhere, especially like on a long trip. The pedal box is tiny. There's a weird little ledge in the footwell there where you can really only kind of put your feet either up on the ledge or down below the ledge. You don't really have any choice. So like on a long drive, you could cramp up. It could be uncomfortable. But if that's not a consideration, then the Camaro is probably the best all-around one, really regardless of what engine you get, because that chassis is just so good.
That's a brilliant chassis. That is, I'm going to try and remember my Greek terms. Is it Zeta or is Zeta the old one?
I do not remember.
Zeta is rear-wheel drive. It may be like a version of Zeta, or they may have come up with a new one. Delta was another one. I feel like that might be the old rear-wheel drive for like the SS or something, or the old G8. But whatever like Greek word it is, yes, I agree completely. And you noticed it right away, like when the, like this was back in, I think, 14 or 15, and the Camaro got that injection of ATS, like chassis components, immediately the car went from being, you know, right in there with the Challenger and the Mustang to being like this really, I think it's the best handling of all three of them. I mean, the Challenger, no comparison, but right. I mean, just it's precise. It's like a technical experience. It's almost like, I would say like, this is probably high praise, but like the Audi of the pony car segment, as far as like a sophisticated chassis, you know, experience that gives you more confidence, perhaps even than you deserve. You know, I've always found myself able to go faster in Camaros than I could in Mustangs, just because of like the turn in, just the way it responded. And maybe that's just my experience, you know, how I drive. I don't know. But yeah. All right. So that's Camaro, Mustang, and a few other performance coupes. Let's make a hard fade here to the Kia Telluride. Beautiful SUV, I think. It's one of the, you know, more important vehicles I think Kia has made in a while. It clearly filled a gap in their lineup and can perhaps attract some new customers. I think it's a great value too. When you look at just how much you could get on a Telluride, just for like the starting price. And you had one for, I think, a week, right?
Yes.
What did you do with it?
So, I didn't do a whole lot with it. I did a couple driveway tests, which you guys will see. It'll be the same week we publish this, so they should be coming up for you. It'll fit a ton of stuff when you put the seats down. It'll fit a ton of people when you keep the seats up. All the things that you need for passenger car are there. If you need a three row, it's a great one. And it's one of the few cars I've driven recently that have actually gotten attention from people kind of out in the world, because they're still very hard to find. There are a lot of people who want to buy Tellurides who can't, because the dealers either don't have them or they're marking them up because they can, and or, you know, for whatever reason, like they just can't find the right spec, stuff like that. Which, I mean, I was sitting at a stoplight not far from home here and had a guy in a smaller crossover of some kind, I don't recall what it was, like a smaller GM, rolled the window down and wanted to ask if I'd bought it locally because he said he couldn't find one with less than about $4,500 in markup on it in the area.
That's
which
crazy.
Is, I mean, considering this thing has been out for over a year now, that's outrageous. Now, obviously, COVID and... I mean, Kia went into it with capacity issues. We knew that. I mean, they said early on that they just didn't have the capacity for it. So that's an issue, obviously one that's still ongoing. But so, you know, he chatted with me for a couple minutes just while we were waiting for the light to turn. And the only other car I've had someone do that with recently was actually the BMW 4 Series I was driving. And they literally just wanted to go, hey, I recognize that that's the new BMW 4 Series. And it was because of the, you know, massive new grill on the front of it. And so they didn't have anything nice to say about it. They just wanted to point out that they knew what I was driving. So you get interesting interactions, especially in the Detroit metro area. But I really don't have a whole lot negative to say about the Telluride. I mean, Kia calls it the Celluride internally. Like, that's their little joking way of referring to it because they literally can't keep the things on lots. They're very good. My only real negative points to point out would be, I think the adaptive cruise control is a little too timid. It's one of those that other people on the road can easily abuse. They can cut you off for days and you'll just go slower and slower and slower and slower until you're not moving anymore. And but apart from that, and the engine response also being kind of tepid from time to time, I mean, it's like all of these big three rows. It has a decent sized V6, but it's tuned for fuel economy. And they're at the kind of limit of how much torque they can deliver through these front-wheel drive transmissions. So we're not going to be seeing, like, twin-turbo versions of these front-wheel drive crossovers, regardless of who they're coming from, especially since half of them share the same transmission to some extent with somebody else, or at least with other cars within their own lineups. So those are the kinds of things you really can't avoid in this space. If you really want a gutsy engine, then you have to go to one of the larger... mid-sizes, basically the Dodge Durango if you need three rows, or Jeep Cherokee if you don't, or Grand Cherokee, I apologize. Or you have to go to the big boys like the Tahoe, Suburban, Expedition, those, where you can get V8s or equivalent. You know, you get the crazy, like, hybrid transmissions and stuff like that, or powertrains in the Ford. So, I mean, for what it is, for the segment it's in, it's hard to beat. Early on, I would have said that the Palisade actually can be a slightly better value, especially because you can get the power folding third row in that one, and it actually ends up costing a little bit less than a fully loaded Telluride if you're going for every option. But I think that's something that's been addressed for the 2021 model year, where they've kind of evened out the equipment between the two of them. So, I mean, it really comes down to styling. You either love the Telluride and you want one, or you want something else. And it's hard to go wrong, but great, great SUV. I instantly recommend it to anybody who's asking for it. I might tell people to skip some of the driver aid type stuff if they don't absolutely need it, but that's down to personal preference, really.
We, we gave some of that driver aid technology our technology of the year earlier this year. It's pretty good, if you will.
Well, but, yeah. I mean, it depends on what you're looking for. Like the lane change assist and stuff like that is great, especially like, yeah. I mean, there are very few times when those features, which are some of the cooler ones, are actually a nuisance. Mm-hmm. Most of them, they work very well. Yeah. They operate as advertised, which you can't really say for tech company-wide across any of the lineups right now. The stuff like that is very good. And the systems work. If you're used to the way adaptive cruise control works in most mainstream cars, it works the same way in the Telluride. Nothing about it's going to throw you off. It's not going to cause you any problems. But for people like me who just prefer old man classic cruise control, if you want to put it that way, it can be annoying. But it's part of the thing for me is that I do most of my driving on long highway trips these days. And that's really all I know in terms of my personal use of vehicles. So I look at things through that lens from time to time. And I think, is this something I'd want to leave on for 5 hours? And sometimes the answer for me is different than it is for other people.
For sure. For sure. I think the Telluride does a brilliant job of raising Kia's status as a brand. If you actually look at a Telluride, the word Telluride is very prominent. Kia mm-hmm. is less so, which, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if that's a little bit on purpose. Because, it, I mean, when you look at it, I think in a vacuum, it's a, I think it's a very good looking vehicle. You wouldn't necessarily know what it is right away. And I think, you know, that was sort of the move Hyundai did when Genesis was its, before it became a mm-hmm. sub brand, it was more like a Hyundai Genesis. And now it's just a Genesis. Do I think right. they're going to do a Telluride sub brand? Probably not. But, I mean, I think this thing is really classy, looks really good. I like the Palisade too. I go back and forth which one I prefer. Right now I'm feeling more Palisade versus Telluride, but I mean that changes. That's purely based on the looks and then, you know, some of the other features, but they're solid vehicles. I mean, would you consider these are the first like true large SUVs that Hyundai and Kia have ever made? I mean, for of this size in this sort of price point, I mean, I think they're tremendous yeah. efforts. They're competitive. They're better and they're better values than many established competitors, you know, having driven, I mean, both of them, you know, fairly extensively, I think, you know, they're very solid, you know, any of the, like the gaps, the areas that they come up short are easily explainable just from like other weaknesses you would see in the segment. Just like, well, the Durango yeah. isn't as good at this, you know, it's, yeah, I think it's an impressive effort. So.
Yeah, absolutely. They're both very good. And I'm looking forward. We're going to have that Palisade in our long-term fleet here pretty soon. So it'll be nice to get a little more time with that to play around with it. But, I mean, the only real strike I have against either of those is that they don't have the dedicated off-roady type trims that you can kind of get from some of the others. They're working on it. Kia did a concept, I think it was last year. Hyundai, I don't know, they probably won't. They're pitching the Palisade as the more kind of like luxury oriented one with the chrome and stuff like that on the exterior. It's a little flashier, a little softer. So it's interesting. Like and it really does just come down to personal preference. That's the beautiful thing about the two of them. I mean, the fundamental car is the same either way. And you're right, in terms of value, I mean they're remarkably good, especially compared to like the Chevy, the number of packages and the amount of money you can spend to create the equivalent, you can spend $7,000 to $10,000 more. And that's a lot of money. You're talking, you know, 25% of the cost of the car up front that you're adding onto it just to get equivalent equipment or to get slightly better equipment. But I don't know that that's worth it. And of course, right now the Telluride's marked up everywhere. So that's kind of a wash, but once you can get them for what they're actually supposed to cost, that's a pretty fantastic car.
It's unbelievable that Kia SUVs are having like a markup like that. So,
yeah,
you know, you're talking about a mainstream brand that it's just their SUV. You know, you don't see that for other vehicles like that. So anyways, speaking of, I guess this is nominally an SUV. Really, it's a crossover coupe. Of course, Ford would tell you first and foremost, it's a Mustang. But we are hearing that the electrified platform will be shared with another vehicle. This is sort of a cryptic thing that we, you know, got word of this morning. Check out the story for all the details. It's authored by Jeremy Korsniewski, our consumer editor. I think we kind of knew this. It made sense. They're going to build this in Mexico, which is how we kind of notice this. It was sort of a factory kind of, you know, just disclosure, if you will. They're talking about some of the other like things that are going to be built and how they're going to be built and where they're going to be built and just investments and things like that. Makes sense. I mean, we're trying to figure out like, what's it going to be? I don't know. Do you have a guess? What do you think?
I think Joel pointed out this morning that the obvious answer is that it'll be a Lincoln mm-hmm. equivalent effectively to the Mustang Mach-E crossover, which of course made us immediately go to the idea of a Mach-E just because, you know, symmetry. But everyone immediately groaned at the thought of that nameplate.
Mach-E.
But I mean,
yeah.
there are a lot of reasons why they shouldn't do that. Certainly more reasons than there are for why they should. But that is the obvious answer, I think. And I mean, aside from that, the only other thing that would make sense to me would be to do some sort of like kind of take on the Hummer EV idea where you do a skateboard chassis pickup. Obviously, it would have to be smaller because the Mach-E is just not that big of a vehicle. But I think there's potential there, especially if they decided to like keep their new electric platform within their icons, which is what they're calling the Mustang and the Bronco and the other, you know, heritage nameplates that they still have in their portfolio. So if they were to do like a Bronco Ranger E or something like that, where they did a Bronco Sport kind of shaped thing with a bed and did it on an EV platform, that would be interesting and different, I think, and probably interesting and different enough to sell. But we already know they're doing the Maverick, which will be a gasoline-powered truck in that same space. And at some point, even the domestics have to realize you can't just turn everything into a pickup truck. So, I mean, as neat of an idea as it would be, I think Lincoln, the obvious answer in this case, is the right one.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense because I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily connect the Mach-E to whatever this Lincoln is called. Be a great place to rebirth the Continental name, which mm-hmm. is just recently, like, as of like weeks ago, going out of production. Electric Continental, that could be cool. I believe there was like a rocker who put an electric conversion in an old Lincoln. It might have been a Continental or it might have been a Mark. I'm forgetting all the details, but that just popped into my head. But I think it makes sense because it would make Lincoln very competitive in the green space. And all of a sudden, like, you could charge more for it. It's a Lincoln. So there's that. And I think what also is good about that is it would make Lincoln more on the cutting edge. It would be, it's not just luxury. It's not just, you know, any other reason you might buy a Lincoln. Like right now, that's design and interior design specifically. But if you could get an electric Lincoln and you could get it out there sooner than, you know, some of these other, you know, sort of electric promises we're seeing, that could be great. But we're also seeing electrification as sort of par for the course. So Lincoln, you know, right now in the lens of 2020, we're sort of seeing, which is a very interesting place to view anything from, right? From the lens of 2020, as I think out loud. But point being, it's like, ooh, electric Lincoln, that's special. Well, yeah, if they built it right now in November 2020, by the time they bring it out, you know, I think we're just going to see more and more. You know, we're looking at electric plug-in Audis. Of course, Tesla is doing a lot of different things. Mercedes, BMW, Volkswagen. There's all sorts of these electric things coming from mainstream brands and luxury brands. If Lincoln didn't have an electric, well, suddenly you're like, well, wait a minute, you're hitting with two strikes against you or something, you know? Yeah. So I think in 2 or 3 years, and then in Cadillac, that was the example I was searching for. Cadillac is going to be very electric as the 20s roll on. So, you know, it's going to be table stakes. I think it makes a ton of sense. They got to get there. That's the obvious play. The less obvious play is, like you said, some sort of Maverick Courier, I don't know, Mustang pickup thing. Not Mustang, but like something that could be like you said, use it as like a skateboard kind of platform and then shape something on top, and what they call it, who knows what that might be.
Right.
It, to me, that's at that point, we're just like sketching spy renderings because we haven't really heard a ton of that. You know, I don't even think they've hinted at anything like that. But it, I mean, when you're looking at what they would do with that platform, that would make some sense too. I mean, there's no other gaps that I see that are obvious where they could use an electrification to plug that hole.
Right. And there's going to be, we learned from a previous, from Ford's labor negotiations, they're going to build electrified crossovers to replace the Ford Edge and Lincoln Nautilus in Ontario, Canada. So they've got something for that kind of mid-size two-row, slightly larger crossover space. And so the absence of an electrified Lincoln beneath that leaves room for a Mach-E platform variant to kind of slot in there nicely. It would also probably make sense for Lincoln to make it like an upmarket nameplate, just because, I mean, Mustang Mach-E for now will be Ford's answer to mainstream EV, but that's only until they come out with a more mainstream EV, right? You have to figure at some point there will be an escape equivalent that will be pure EV, and maybe even something smaller than that down the line. I mean, it seems like it's inevitable at this point. So the Lincoln really has a lot of breathing room here, especially since they already have plug-in hybrid electric transmission and engine options in their lineup. That the modular rear-wheel drive hybrid transmission we know has been pitched for other products. We don't know which ones specifically yet. Ford won't confirm any of that. But so the hybrids are going to spread around both the Ford and Lincoln lineups even more than they already have. And that's going to include rear-wheel drive vehicles that are currently not electrified. So, I mean, the roadmap for the next 5 to 10 years is obviously not set in stone, and it's going to be full of a whole bunch of interesting electrification strategies. So it's going to be cool to see how it plays out.
You know what's interesting? I just thought of this. We haven't seen like a platform stablemate for the Mustang since the Mercury Cougar. And it's been a while. Like the Mustang at times has had, like when Mercury was a thing, they had like a sibling car.
Right.
Yeah, and sometimes the cars were very different, very significantly different, to the point where like it almost wasn't even apropos to like compare them. But sometimes they actually were somewhat close.
Yeah.
So this could be interesting. And what I think is kind of neat is the Mach-E is a crossover, if you will. It's like a sports coupe inspired crossover. But if you look at it, you know, I'm not sure exactly how it's going to ride or drive and handle all that stuff. They say it's going to be amazing and sporty, but it does have a rather crossovery silhouette in the back. You know, I've made the case that the Blazer is very Camaro like appearing. Chevy could have called that like a Camaro with just a few more style tweaks, maybe get rid of those plastic wheel arches, lower the ride height a little bit. It's still a crossover silhouette, but it's, you know, a little more of a, like, you get more of that, like, cargo space and layout of a crossover. So,
yeah,
like, to me, when I look at the Mach-E, I think it looks great. I think it's totally legit that they're doing it the way they're doing it. But it's interesting because, I don't know, in some ways, there's almost this, like, there's the dissonance, you know, between the enthusiasts, like, well, that's not a sports coupe. You're right, it's not. And then you look at the Blazer, and it's like, well, wait a minute, that's a really long hood on a crossover. That's quite the grill.
Right.
and that's the Mach-E's playbook to say that it's a Mustang, in addition to all this electrification performance. To bring this all together, what I'm trying to say is if you called it like an electric Continental or an electric Mach or another, I don't know, bring back the Zephyr name, if you ask me, or something, go back to the 30s, don't go back to the early 2000s, and, you know, just call it like a Zephyr Zephyr like performance electric crossover, nobody's gonna have any like, you know, dissonance or anger over the fact that your Lincoln sports coupe is a little too crossover. You know, you lose that like heartburn that I think some people had with the Mustang name. I was not among them, but you know, read our comments and there were people there and who didn't like that idea. So
yeah, and it's funny too, because just if you go back, I mean, you used the word dissonance earlier. I think that's a perfect word for it. You look at how people were hyping up the idea of Lincoln sedan, or I'm sorry, Mustang sedans and Mustang wagons and stuff like that. Even just within the past decade, everyone was really hyped for the idea of like, oh, it's going to be like a Mustang shooting brake, or oh, it's going to be this, or it's going to be that. Especially because the new Mustang does share some kind of platform DNA with the old Lincoln rear-wheel drive sedans. So, yeah, there was this idea, you know, the rumors were going for years that there were going to be Mustangs that were capable of holding more people. And then suddenly you get a Mustang crossover that's electric. And that's, I mean, a lot of people went, oh, well, there you go. The rumors were true. Here's a Mustang crossover. It can hold more people. And everyone's the enthusiasts are like, wait, no, that's not what we wanted. I'm genuinely not in the purist camp on this one. I think the Mach-E is perfectly valid. I mean, it was a weird choice, but I don't think it's that big of a deal personally. I think people get a little too hung up on branding disguised as nostalgia, and you have to find a way to cut that differently. So if the Mach-E is good, the Mach-E is good. The Mach-E is bad, the Mach-E is bad. The fact that it's a Mustang doesn't play into it, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
Cool. And I think the You know, we'll just, I think we'll see on this one, because some of Ford's like product plans, it seems like there've been some tweaks with them, at least is what we publicly know, versus some of the, like, the rumors. Like, again, you know, to go back to like the Courier and the Maverick, it's like, these are like almost open secrets, but then, you know, I think automotive journalists are pretty good at like sleuthing out what's coming next and what, you know, how it's going to shake out. This one kind of came out of nowhere. So how about we spend some money? I should say give an update on this week's Spend My Money. I believe Dave from Houston writing in about, he sent us a request, saying basically he needed like sports coupe to put some people and kids in and was open to a bunch of different options. So let's walk you through it. He ended up buying a 2005 911 Carrera S with the 6-speed manual in midnight blue. Well, that sounds very good. It had 116,000 miles on it. It's a 4-seater naturally, so he could put both of his kids in the car. He wants to get them excited about sports cars. He somehow got 2 car seats back there, which I applaud him for. I mean, it's doable. I've put car seats in all sorts of things, but that's a tricky way to do it. Let me put it that way. And it was rear-wheel drive. Would have been open to all-wheel drive. Check. Reliable and inexpensive to maintain. This is kind of funny. Check. Sort of, but not really. It was great mechanical condition when he got it, but the previous owner drove it a lot, hence the 116 miles on the clock. But he hasn't had to do anything major, so that's good. Targeted going for 20 grand. Check. Sort of. Stretched for a bit, but so worth it. I don't see an actual buying price on here, but that's okay. And then easily was able to find it in the used market, thanks to the internet. So overall, he loves it. The car seats fit great. Good visibility, which is really good. Obviously, a good powertrain going on there. He still has the 4Runner. And of course, this is what it came down for me, was the classic 911, which you could, I think those are well bought in this era of 911s. You get just enough, like, time has passed at these cars, like the dynamics and the essence of what they are has changed a little bit, but it's still a 911. But buying a car that old, you're not going to be afraid to drive a little bit that's got that many miles on it. So thanks for writing, Dave. Pretty good update. Any thoughts on this? I think sounds like something you might have concurred with, Byron, had you been on the show.
Yeah, actually, if you ask my friends, I've been in the process of theoretically buying a Dodge Viper for like the last 3 years of my life.
Nice.
But every once in a while, I get this idea that I'm just going to buy something kind of like what he's looking for. I don't have and have no plans for kids, but the idea of just like a somewhat practical but still sporty car, the 911 does tick those boxes, unless you actually have children that are large enough that you don't want to be putting them in the back seat anymore. But and I can attest to pricing on this. He probably did not have to stretch very much, because I've looked at some 911 C4Ss, so Carrera 4s, the all-wheel drive versions of this same generation, either a late 996 or an early 997. And even on sites like Cars and Bids and stuff like that, they seem to be going for low to mid 20,000s with reasonable miles on them. And I'd consider 100,000 miles on a car that old to be reasonable. So the price is right. It's also the time to buy these, really, especially if you're going to drive them, because they're only going to start getting more expensive pretty much. Their depreciation has bottomed, and within 5 to 10 years they'll start to creep back up again. Even if you've convinced yourself that the 996 broken egg headlamp Porsches are never going to be valuable, that's what people said about the 914. So go find yourself a clean 914 for less than an outrageous amount of money, and then tell yourself that the 996 won't be worth plenty in, you know, 10 to 15 years. So don't knock it unless you drive it. And then, you know, it's a good buy. Now's the time to do it. And they do actually, despite the engine issues and stuff like that, for the most part, they do seem to be fairly reliable and relatively reasonable to maintain, which is pretty much the same language he was using when he described whether that checked the box for him or not. So I hear exactly what he's saying there.
I think it's, as far as daily driving, such as it is, I think this is a really good buy for him. I think your Viper purchase, I would I don't think I'd ever necessarily need to own one. I've driven the Viper. I love the Viper, but it's like a car that will rip your head off, man. And it's like, it's definitely not for me a daily driver. And I've been fortunate to drive some, you know, pretty fierce cars. I think I'd be interested in the Viper if I lived in the middle of nowhere and just had open roads where I couldn't really hurt myself or anyone else unless I did something stupid, you know,
right?
That sort of thing. Or if I was more of like into consistent going to tracks, that sort of thing. But the Viper, you don't want to be too far away from anybody because, you know, they might need, you might need to call for help if you will, you know, that's, there's a tricky car there, but I mean, Vipers are amazing though. I've driven a couple generations of them and they're, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, what would you do with a Viper? I'm just curious. Is this like an idea? You'd look at it. Okay.
I mostly want to look at it. Yeah. I mean, okay. I'm at the stage where the cars that are in my driveway and my garage really don't get driven all that often anyway. So, but I mean, yeah, it's a get it out and have a nice weekend kind of car, but certainly not something I would want to daily drive. But yeah, I've lusted after, it's been my dream car since I was old enough to appreciate cars.
An awesome car.
I had multiple Viper posters. I still own multiple diecast models of Vipers. I don't actually have any of them in the office with me. They're in different parts of the house. But I've lusted after it for a very long time. And I think especially it's considered the second generation from 1996 to 2002 when they went to the double bubble fixed roof of the GTS. I think that's one of the best looking cars that's ever been made. And it's just pure, stupid, great big engine in a tiny little car, the way Carroll Shelby intended back in the day with the Cobras. And it's a perfect riff on that that's modern enough to not kill you outright, but still very, very raw. And, you know, it's just one of those things where everything about it is kind of a little extra, and that appeals to me.
So your statement there about you'd look at it, I agree. Mm-hmm. I also interviewed Ralph Giels one time, who's the Fiat Chrysler head of design, of course. He's had a number of jobs there. And this was for another publication back in the day. This was, wow, this was over 10 years ago. And I have a quote in the story where basically I like asked him, hey, what do you do with it? You know, because he was a longtime Viper advocate. And he's like, yeah, I don't get to drive as much as I'd like, but half the time I'm just sitting there eating cereal and looking at the Viper in my garage, which is like, he really drives cars too. You know, if you know him, you follow him on Instagram, he really has some fun with cars, which is great. But I think that's kind of like, you know, with the Viper, you buy it because obviously you have the skills to drive one. Like, you know, maybe for you, it's like your dream car. I don't know if I'd say it's my dream car, but I've always really liked Vipers. And then there's also like the practical part of it where you're like, well, maybe you'd have a 911. You might take it out and drive it. But if you have the Viper, it's like you get that second, like, you know, dissonance, you know, to use the word of the podcast. You're like, yeah, I don't know. Man, I'm a little tired today. We're going to let the Viper sit. You know, I don't know. Let, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, the air conditioning systems in those are kind of a suggestion. And I mean, they're at the age too, where even if they were in prime condition, they wouldn't work all that well. But I mean, it's a time capsule car.
For
it
sure.
Was the last time FCA really pulled itself out of a slump, not talking about the more recent time, but prior to that, you know, like it was one of those like statement cars. It's very Bob Lutz. It's very, let's go out there and do something stupid. And I feel like that's the attitude you have to have every time you pick up the keys, regardless of what generation it is. It's like, okay, let's go be dumb.
It's one of the most intense cars I think I've ever driven, you know, bar none. Like, I can't think of, like, it's a completely different vibe than, like, an R8, like, you know, all sorts of different Huracans, Aventadors. I mean, it's just, it's intense, you know? It's like, it goes back to almost like a different era of like how cars, just the way they would feel and like what you would have to do to drive them properly. And yeah, I don't know, have you been price shopping them at all?
Yeah, I've actually gone so far as to make an offer on a couple.
Oh, wow.
I've got one offer still outstanding right now. That's a California car, which would be kind of a pain to get it back home. Because, yeah, I'm here in the Greg and I are both in the greater Detroit area. So, yeah, I looked at one actually in your neck of the woods. I looked at one in Troy just this past Saturday. It was a little older and rougher than I would like. The paint on it looked like it had been, put in three different types of sun for the majority of its life. So that one wasn't quite what I was looking for, but just getting in it, firing it up, it further reinforced the notion that I need that in my life. So
I would compare it to the Lambo Countach, as far as just like, it's easier to drive than a Countach or a Countach, depending on which way you subscribe, but not much. The visibility is slightly better because if you drive the Lambo, you're basically laying down. And obviously it's like, it's got, the steering's more intense, whereas the Lambo, it's like there's no steering, but you still have to work really, really hard to turn it. I drove one of those in Miami one time and that was a trip, man.
I believe it.
So yeah, I think we could leave it there. Maybe someday we'll spend Byron's money. We'll get like a Viper segment on here. And I think, you've got me convinced. Next time we have you on here, maybe we should just do a Viper segment. I don't know what it's on, but
I don't know either, but trust me, I'll talk about it for hours.
There we go. Maybe that's what it is. We won't even like storyboard or prep it out. We'll just roll the ball out and see what the final score is.
All right.
Sounds good. All right. That'll be an upcoming podcast. We'll tease it out. We'll leave it right there. Everybody be safe out there. We hope you're enjoying the fall. Until next time.